yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Okay. Our guest today is Ellen Brown. We're going to bring Ellen back, and it should be a very interesting show here. Ellen, if you don't know, is president of the Public Banking Institute. She's also the shadow treasurer for the Green Shadow Cabinet, author of several recent books on public banking, including The Public Bank Solution, her most recent published book here last year, and prior to that, The World of Debt, both published by Third Millennium Press. So look it up on the Amazon or wherever you buy your books. She's also a journalist with many recent articles on the corrupt and pro-corporate banking system we have in the U.S. and globally, and what to do about it, i.e. the public bank as an alternative that make banks a utility. Her latest articles can be found on Huffington Post, Counterpunch, and a number of other places as well. But we're bringing her back today to talk about her newly announced candidacy for the treasurer of the state of California. Okay, but we also want to work into our discussions at some point along the show her view about what is called bail-ins. We'll explain that if you don't know what that is. And her take on the Bitcoin phenomenon, i.e. digital tulips, as I like to call it. And her recent announcement, you know, on their candidacy, and also on perhaps if she has some comments on what appears to be a growing accelerating retreat from banking regulation across the board in the U.S. and in Europe here. Ellen, you have some blogs. Why don't you tell us so listeners can jump onto your blog here. What's the best blog? I know you got a couple of them.
Well, my blog for where all my articles are is ellenbrown.com, and then I have one for a campaign one, which is at ellenbrown4treasurer.org, but it's for the number four.
Number four, Ellen Brown, four, number, treasurer.org. Look it up. Follow her as she takes on the big money interest here in the state of California, and they are big and they are many. Okay. Let's start with the obvious question, Ellen. What convinced you to run for treasurer in California, and what are you going to do if you make it?
What possessed me, in other words, right?
Yes, possessed you, yes.
Well, 2.5 years ago, I had a bill for, and I'm president of the Public Banking Institute, and so the thing that I'm always pushing for is that we should have publicly owned banks, that private banks are unnecessarily draining huge sums off of the economy. It's basically a parasitic arrangement where they're pulling money out and putting it into money-making money schemes, so they're not putting it back into the economy, so it's just continually sucking money out. It's a lot more money than we think. Of course, they take out interest, which you think, well, okay, 3 or 4%, no big deal. But if you stretch that percentage over 20 or 30 years, we know when you buy a house, you're going to pay at least as much in interest, probably, as you paid in principal. And it's the same thing for public projects like bridges and roads. For example, the Bay Bridge retrofitting boondoggle, when the bridge collapsed in the earthquake, they rebuilt that. It was supposed to be $5 billion. It turned out to be $10 billion. So it was 50% was interest. So that was money going to lenders. And if we owned the bank, if we were borrowing from ourselves, we could save that money. in California, we used to have all sorts of benefits that we don't have now. In the 1960s, under Pat Brown, who is Jerry Brown's father, I went to Berkeley in the 1960s, and tuition was free. It's now, I think, $13,000 a year. I went to UCLA Law School in the 70s. Tuition was $700 a year. It's now $45,000 for an in-state student. I mean, it's an unbelievable sum for tuition. And the reason they're paying that is because they got caught in these interest rate swaps. They got caught in derivatives. They wound up on the wrong side of these bets. If you ask me, the betting was rigged because the house controls the game. They're betting against interest rates going up, and in fact, of course, they went down, so they went the opposite way, and that was under the control of the Federal Reserve, which you would be the head of in our green cabinet shadow banking system, so you might say what you might
we
say
share
what
a lot
you
of views together.
That.
Yes, that's true. Yes. When you said they, let me for our listeners clarify, you mean the colleges, the universities, got into these toxic deals, like interest rate swaps and so forth, as did a lot of K through 12 school districts and a lot of
right.
cities and so forth across the country. So the ripoff by the banks is
right.
not just charging excess interest and, not paying us anything, which of course is happening, but it's this big speculative binge that's been going on for a very long time, and it's not really stopping that you're referring to. And of course, when you have these losses, whether you're cities, then you take it out on the pensions of the workers, right? And if you're universities, you take it out on the students by charging, huge cost of education, which, by the way, is rising faster than just about any other service cost in the economy today. Correct?
Jack, please continue. She lost her line.
Oh, excuse me. I didn't hear you. Well, sorry, folks. We had a little problem here with Ellen, and we lost her in the middle of our interview, but our engineer is going to try to get her back. I don't know how much listeners heard of my commentary, but basically what I was just making a comment following up to Ellen, where Ellen mentioned how university costs of education have escalated so dramatically, and a lot of that has to do with universities and colleges that have had gotten involved with the banks trying to make some extra returns by speculating with the banks on interest rate swaps and other kinds of derivatives and had big losses. And I had mentioned, at the risk of repeating myself, that what happened, with universities also happened with cities and school districts and so forth over the last decade, where the bankers talked them into getting involved in these toxic deals, and both cities and school districts, lost huge amounts of money, as did 401k plans. And, of course, people's pensions as a result have collapsed. We lost $7 trillion in 401k wealth. The country has recovered about $2 trillion of that, so we're still $5 trillion down. A lot of this has to do with the private banking system, which is all about speculating on behalf of their very wealthy, what I call the global money parade investors. In a recent piece that I wrote, The Investors, the Global Money Parade, the shadow bank, $71 trillion. Now, of assets in the shadow banking system, far greater than even a regulated banking system, and these ultra-high net worth individuals who make $30 million a year on the investments as a minimum are increasing their wealth at $4 trillion a year every year. Well, they couldn't do it without the private banking system. Did I hear you, Ellen? Are you back with us?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, okay. I don't know what happened, but we got cut off, so we just repeated ourselves a little bit. Sorry, listeners. We're back with Ellen. Ellen, the question was,
okay,
you're taking on the big boys. Tell us why.
Yeah, so 2.5 years ago, there was a bill brought by Ben Hueso in San Diego for a feasibility study for a state-owned bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota, which is our own, currently our only state-owned bank. North Dakota is also the only state that escaped the credit crisis. They have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest foreclosure rate on credit card debt, the lowest default rate. I mean, sorry, the lowest default rate on credit card debt, the lowest foreclosure rate, and no state debt at all. So they're doing very well. And this, their state-owned bank has returned a very nice dividend to the state every year. They have a return on equity of between 17 and 26%, or have since 2008. So it's an excellent model. And there was a bill to study whether that would work in California. And it passed both houses of the legislature. And our Public Banking Institute was in there pushing for it. I did a PowerPoint in Sacramento and so forth. And so it got quite far, but Jerry Brown failed to sign it. And he said it was because we had too many committees already and we didn't need another committee and that we could study this in-house in their banking committee. But we never heard any more about it.
Yeah, so, I wonder how much Jerry Brown got in campaign contributions here from the banks in California. I wonder if that has something to do with it. By the way, you mentioned the boondoggle of the Bay, the new Bay Bridge extension here, $10 billion. Well, you know, Jerry Brown was behind that. The two Browns, Willie Brown, San Francisco, Jerry Brown, mayor of Oakland at the time, as they both left office, you know, pushed that boondoggle of that $10 billion bridge when we already had a bridge. You know, Jerry Brown is tied in with the big bankers as well. Go ahead.
So I have to go in and rectify the name of the Browns. Maybe the female Browns will do better. So we would like to, Laura Wells ran for governor on the Green Party ticket several years ago on a state bank platform. And, of course, Green Party is take no corporate money. And, therefore, we can be independent of the banks and we can stand up to the banks. So she thought if she ran for controller and I ran for treasurer, we could get in there and get our state bank. We can peer into the books, find out how much money there is tucked away in, you know, California has at least $200 billion in rainy day funds all over the state, plus another $200 billion in the pension fund, plus I think currently it's about $54 billion in the treasurer's investment pool, which is invested at 0.26% interest. So it's making almost no interest. That money's just sitting there. You could take that chunk of money, even if you can't spend it, you can deposit it in your own bank, or you can invest it as capital in your own bank, some of each maybe, and leverage that. You could turn that into $54 billion in credit, even while the money's still sitting there in the bank. That's the way banking works, where you leverage capital and credit into capital and deposits into credit for the community equal to what you started with.
Well, did I hear you just say that California is sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars? Well, wait a minute. Everyone says, oh, California's broke. California's broke. Where's the mismatch? And if we have a couple hundred billion dollars in these funds, as you said a minute ago, if we had a public bank, and if the North Dakota bank is returning 17 to 20%, wow, we could be earning 17 to 20% on hundreds of billions of dollars?
Right. So that alone is reason to start our own bank. We could give ourselves, well, we'll be giving ourselves that percentage. Let's see. Say you take some capital, you invest it in your bank, then you use the deposit, turn the deposits into credit. So let's say you put the, you could either partner with local banks, which is what they do in North Dakota, and then the local bank makes the loans into the community to viable businesses, et cetera. They don't make bad loans. I mean, they're not out there to save companies from going under. They're out there to make good loans that Wall Street's not interested in making, or that, you know, you hear about businesses all the time that are perfectly good businesses that used to have a cheap credit line with their bank, and suddenly they're forced to do credit cards, which is twice the interest rate. So So it's those businesses that are viable businesses, but right now the credit climate is just bad. They just can't, the banks can't lend because of capital requirements, et cetera. So you partner with the local banks. They make these good loans into the community, make some money on them the way banks do, and that is your profit, which allows you to give a good return on your capital. Of course, you can leverage your capital to 10 times. You could, like, $10 of capital will get you $100 in loans if the 100 backed by an equivalent sum of deposits. But that $100 in loans, let's say it's at 5%, so you're making $5 on your $10 of capital right there. You make a 50% on your $10 of capital right there.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing to me and the model in North Dakota is kind of like, a public state bank would function like a mini Federal Reserve within the state. In other words, loaning money to other banks at cost, not without a profit tacked on top of it, and that would stimulate loans to small businesses and mortgage loans and auto loans and so forth to the people of California. Is that sort of what this scenario is?
Yeah, they do act as a mini Fed. Of course, they can't create money on their books technically the way the Fed does, but all banks create money on their books in the form of bank credit. I mean, that's where most of our money comes from, not from the Fed, but from private banks. In North Dakota, what they do, though, they don't actually lend to the local banks. They participate in the loan. So the local bank gets the customer. They're the front man. So you're not competing with these banks. You're sharing. You're partnering with them. So they get the loan. But let's say it's some development or something that they're just not big enough to handle. So then they will partner with the Bank of North Dakota, which brings in extra liquidity, extra capital, allows them to make the loans. So let's say it's two-thirds comes from the Bank of North Dakota. They'll get two-thirds of the profit, and the local bank will get one-third. But this allows them to expand their range for what kind of loans they can make.
And why couldn't this state bank simply loan directly to consumers? Why would they have to even limit themselves to loaning to local banks?
Well, there are different models, and that is what they do in Costa Rica, for example, where 80% of deposits are in publicly owned banks, and they operate just like private banks. They compete with the private banks, and in fact, the private banks can't compete with them because they're such a better deal for the people. So you could do that, but the problem is you're going to have political problems just getting established because you'll be competing with bankers, and bankers own the world or own the country. So you need to have an arrangement where you're actually partnering with the banks just to get your foot in the door, it seems to me.
So it's kind of a strategic strategy move here. Divide the opposition, the banking opposition. Let the smaller banks see the public banking initiative as a plus. And in that way, strengthen the smaller banks, and the big boys, Chase and Wells and so forth, that dominate everything. By the way, folks, there's only a dozen or so big banks in this country. There's about 7,000 small banks in this country, and the small banks have not recovered, whereas the big banks, like the Chase and so forth, these folks have recovered and then some quite nicely. As you know, Ellen, the Federal Reserve has pumped over $10 trillion, that's a low estimate probably, in loans and reloans to the banking system in the U.S. and globally since 2008. And then the Fed went and printed money and bought another $4 trillion of bad assets from wealthy investors and banks. So somewhere around $14, $15 trillion has bailed out the banks. Have we seen much of that? Have they stimulated lending and so forth? No. The banking system is really for the very rich, and the rest of us sort of get a crumb now and then at great interest rates. Oh, I just had to get that out. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's totally true. And I think that's our hope, really. In 2008, we almost had to go with it because they were saying they're too big to fail and it'd be a big disaster if we let them collapse. And this will, once we save the banks, then they'll save the economy. They'll be issuing credit and get things rolling again. But we've seen that didn't happen. It only served the banks and it didn't serve the people. So, and once you figure out what they're up to, when you see what the Federal Reserve has done, the fact that they've just issued, like you say, $4 trillion in money created on their books, and it didn't create a hyperinflation. And, it didn't really do anything. So why couldn't we create $4 trillion and give very low-interest loans to state and local governments or to local businesses or to students? Why couldn't we buy, instead of buying up those bad mortgage-backed securities, why couldn't they buy up student debt and just rip it up? What harm would it do? They've done basically the same thing by buying up these mortgage-backed securities and just holding them on their books. Why not?
Yeah, and by the way, listeners should know that $4 trillion in what's called QE, quantitative easing, where the Fed goes and buys up the bad assets, you know, remember subprimes and things like that? That $4 trillion, we don't know how much the Fed has paid for each one of those deals, because the Fed does not report individual purchases. My guess is the Fed has gone out there and spent $4 trillion buying up bad assets above the market value of those assets held by those very rich ultra net worth individuals. You know, those are the folks who directly benefited. You know, wouldn't it have been nice if the Fed had just spent maybe a trillion of that $4 trillion to buy up the bad mortgages of people underwater instead of foreclosing? You can imagine what would have happened to the economy and recovery if they had done that instead. You know, or okay. What if if the Fed had spent $1 trillion and the government used it to directly hire workers, particularly in the alternative energy area and so forth? Do you think we'd have 20 million people still unemployed today? No. You know, as you're pointing out, this is not rocket science. This is a simple solution.
Mm-hmm. People say, well, that argument was raised. I think Elizabeth Warren said that the student should be able to borrow from the Federal Reserve at 0.75% if the banks can. And then people said, well, there's a difference because the banks are good credit risks and the students are bad credit risk. But we've seen that the banks are good credit risk because the government is underwriting them. If they weren't, they would be really bad credit risk. They would have gone under in 2008. So why couldn't the government stand behind the students? In other words, guarantee them a job when they get out of school. That's what they do in Australia and New Zealand. They give I think they're zero interest loans to students, and then they only have to pay them back when they have a job. It doesn't accumulate when they don't have a job. And it's worked out fine. It hasn't bankrupted the country. We could do the same thing. Our Fed could, I think tuition should be free, just like it was in the 60s, certainly for state schools. The only reason it's not is because they have this huge debt burden that they're carrying. And then or at least make very low interest loans and then allow them to guarantee them a job when they get out of school. They could do that. They could pay for the jobs with some $1 trillion coins. I mean, there's so many ways they could come up with money if we just realized what money is all about. Why is it that we say only banks can create money and we don't allow our government, who is us, to create the money needed to run the economy? Clearly, we need more money in the system.
Well, yeah, there. Folks should remember, too, that much of the history of the U.S. From 1789 the government did create the money. And it wasn't until 1913 that we created a Federal Reserve, which, by the way, was created strictly for the purposes of bailing out the banks. People don't know their own history. 1907-8, big financial crash. The private banks tried to bail themselves out. Couldn't. They called on the U.S. Treasury. Treasury put in just about all that it had to bail out the banks. it looked like another similar crisis was going to happen in 1912, 1914, so they created the Federal Reserve, the purpose of which was first and foremost to bail out the banks, to socialize the cost of bank bailouts whenever there was a financial crisis, which occurred periodically and regularly under the capitalist system. People think that the Fed's all about regulating the money supply and supervising the banks. No, 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 no. Whenever the need of bank bailout comes up, you know, the hell with the money supply issue and the hell with bank supervision, bail out the banks. That's all that the Fed is really about. Sorry, I had to get that out. I had an article recently, if folks can go to my website, which is called Bernanke's Bank, an assessment looking at the history of the Federal Reserve since 1913, and that's what it's all about, bailing out the big banks. But what you're talking about, Ellen, is why can't the Federal Reserve or central banks at a state level or federal level really provide money directly at no profit, you know, at the cost of whatever the money is, to the rest of the country? You know, why do we have to have this private rip-off banking system standing between the people and the government and sucking out all these super profits in the process?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that in the 19th century, the government did issue the money. At that time, originally, coins were a major part of the money supply. The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And in 1865, when they had the
National Banking Act.
The National Banking Act. There was some banking communications back and forth, saying let the government issue the coins and the bankers will issue the paper money. That was thought to be fair then. So the bankers were issuing these banknotes that actually said the name of their bank on it, and it really was a promissory note from the bank. It was basically, you've left your gold with us, so here's a promissory note so you can get the gold back whenever you come for it. But, of course, the bankers quickly figured out, or they had figured out, like in the hundreds of years earlier, that they could lend more paper notes than they had gold, and that was the basis of the fractional reserve system. But the coins were supposed to be real money. I mean, something you could really build a bridge with, or something that you really could fund things with. And they got smaller and smaller. And in the 1980s, there was a congressional committee that looked at the coinage, and there was some man, I think he was head of the Mint, and he said, "Well, you know, under the Constitution that." If Congress wanted to, they could just issue, he said, billion-dollar coins, just issue some billion-dollar coins, and they could solve their problems. And so what did Congress do? Instead of taking that great idea, like, wow, here we have the solution to our problems, instead of doing that, they reduced the number of coins that Congress, you know, they put a limit on what the Mint could make, like only so many nickels, so many dimes, so many quarters. But they left one exception, which was the platinum coin, which was supposed to be a commemorative thing. But if the federal government wanted to, they could still issue a couple of platinum trillion-dollar coins and fix some budget problems. Everybody
Yes, well, whatever the solution, it's not all that difficult. But the key is getting these for-profit, blood-sucking private banks out of the picture. Which is easily done, but politically not so easily done, of course.
Right.
We're going to take a break here, Ellen, but I want you to, when we come back, tell folks what, if you were treasurer of California, what would be your immediate program? What would you immediately attempt to introduce or implement in California? Okay, we're going to take a brief break here and come right back. And we'll also want to talk later in the show, Ellen, about bitcoins and bail-ins. I think people need to know something about that. So this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll be back shortly with my guest, Ellen Brown.
Now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming. I can see the light.
jack of all trades will be all right.
This is your host, Jack Rasmus, and my guest is Ellen Brown, and we're talking about, obviously, the banking system, but more specifically about Ellen's run for state treasurer in California here. And Ellen, if you were the state treasurer in California, what would be your program? What would you propose to do, your top priorities, as quickly as possible?
Well, I am sort of a one-trick pony, but my first and foremost effort would be to try to get a state-owned bank set up. And then I think we could fund many things. For example, the bullet train, which I don't think was necessarily a good idea, but you could definitely save a huge amount of money on the bullet train. It's the same as the retrofitting the bridge problem, that you could probably save half of it by funding it through your own bank. But the first thing I would probably have to do would be to do a lot of talking to persuade other people that this is the way to go and that this is what we need. And I would spend a lot of time peering into the books and finding out what we've really got. And there are, of course, legal issues, and I'm a lawyer. I would argue some of those things, like that you can't use this fund for that thing. It seems to me that you could tweak some of those laws. They were probably put in there to protect certain vested interests. Well, we should change those and make them all serve the people. I mean, that's all taxpayer money, but you can't get that money together to use it for anything because this is earmarked for this. And I know there was a when Governor Schwarzenegger tried to use the highway fund money for the general budget, that somebody sued, and the court said, no, that's earmarked for highways. You have to use it for highways. So, but they don't use it. They've got that $54 billion that's just sitting there, and if you look over the last decade, it hasn't changed. It goes up a bit, and it goes down a bit, but they don't really use it.
That $54 billion is sitting where? In what?
It's the treasurer's investment pool. So it's a little bit from here and a little bit from there. You know, he's the treasurer is in charge of figuring out where you're going to invest that stuff. And so then there are these very limiting rules on what you can do with it. It has to be very conservative. And but there's no reason you couldn't, for example, invest it in your own bank. And you might have to change some rules, in other words. So I would probably have to do a lot of arguing and legal research to show that this is the way we should go.
Well, let's assume that you succeeded in that and you opened up that fund somehow. Where would you have the state public bank immediately invest? Would it be student loans? Would it be folks to refinance their underwater loans and their mortgages? Would it be for other infrastructure in California? What would you earmark the money for?
Well, I don't know that would be up to the treasurer. I think my job would be to set up a system where the legislature can have access to more money than what they have right now. I'm sure they've all been squeezed. They've all been forced into slashing all sorts of services in order to balance the budget. And if you could get some blood back in there, there's this tourniquet on the whole thing, starting with Prop 13. But I don't think there's much hope of restoring. Proposition 13 was it limited what you could tax homeowners, and it limited the ability to.
So why would a state, California State Public Bank, be limited to just determining investments from this $54 billion treasury's
investment pool?
Oh, they wouldn't.
But you would set up the bank, and then the bank is an independent. I mean, you want bankers running the bank. You don't want politicians, and you don't even want the treasurer running the bank, it seems to me. you want to set up this vehicle for generating revenues for the state and generating credit for the state. And then the bankers, we on our board, the Public Banking Institute Advisory Board, we have a retired Bank of North Dakota man, and he insists, he says, when people ask about corruption and political manipulation and all that, he says, we are not politicians, and we are not a development agency. We are bankers, and we make reasonable, their mandate is to serve the public, so they don't get bonuses, fees, commissions. They don't make any extra money for speculating or for, you know, they don't make anything personal off of wheeler dealing with the potential of a bank like they do in Wall Street. Their mandate is to serve the public. They're civil servants, and they get paid for making good, solid, responsible loans, and that's what they do. So it seems to me if you set up a bank, then the bank itself would be available for the necessary credit. And if you want to, you could do bond issues or you know, you could back bond issues, or in other words, you could put all your you could invest in bonds instead of making loans. That's what they actually did. The Bank of North Dakota did for a long time was they just bought very secure bonds, but then they discovered that they could branch out into real banking and make more money and do more good for the community. And they've been very stable. You know, there's nothing risky about them. They've got their own. They built up their own capital base, so if they should make a bad bet, it is not the government's money. It's the capital that has been generated by the bank itself that they would put at risk.
Well, you described earlier, though, in North Dakota, how the public bank there gets involved with loans, underwriting loans, with the smaller private banks. For worthy projects, in other words, helping these other local banks, of which there are many throughout the U.S., many in California, engage in worthy projects. But that sort of suggests that the public bank has a big say as to what those worthy projects are. Would you identify, if you had a public bank in California, what the new worthy projects might be, other than
If we did it like the Bank of North Dakota, I don't think the treasurer has a say over what they invest in, because they're very careful to keep arm's length from politics, so they won't be accused of being manipulated by politicians.
So are they just sort of providing credit to the other banks, and that's it?
Yeah. Well, no, they make 1%. They do make some direct loans. They make 1% loans to startup businesses and startup farmers, and they make low interest loans to students. They had a very good student loan program for a long time until the federal government took it over, but they still have a student loan program for their own North Dakota students. But, you know, realistically, I probably shouldn't concede this in public, but John Chang is very likely to win. He's the current controller, so my real goal here is to get this idea out there, get it in front of voters who would not otherwise even have been aware of it. You know, the type of people that just, I used to be one of these people. You're so busy and you just turn on the news and watch the first 10 minutes and that's about all you know about what's going on, and you don't read about things like public banks or any sort of unusual ideas. So as a candidate, we get to have a ballot statement for $25 a word. You can go up to 250 words. So if you want to pay $6,000, you can get a statement in front of all the voters, which is pretty remarkable considering. So, I mean, that alone seems like worth the effort. So that's my first goal, and I think, assuming that we don't actually get elected, I think the way that we would ultimately get our state-owned bank would be by an initiative. But at the moment, people don't understand the concept well enough to do an initiative. It's not like marijuana or abortion or gay marriage or anything like that, where people have a, they already know what they think, you know, and you walk into a supermarket and you say, would you like to sign my petition for a state-owned bank? They'll say, I don't believe in the state. I don't believe in banks. You know, we got too many banks, that kind of thing. I mean, they just won't understand why this is a good idea.
But I would guess that if somehow you could connect the idea of public bank with some very significant gain or benefit to people, that their ears would perk up and they would listen. As long as you don't talk in bank speak. In other words, if you could say a public bank, folks, means you're going to be able to get the same kind of loans that other banks get from a central bank. In other words, you'll be able to borrow at 0.75% in order to refinance your house. Or students, you'd be able to borrow at 0.75% to pay for your education. I think people's ears would, antennas would go up and they'd say, well, gee, that sounds like a pretty good idea.
Yep, and good point. I should think that through. The Bank of North Dakota does give those 1% loans for those things, startup business, startup farms, and cheap loans for students.
Yeah, it's all about the message. It's all about the spin, you know, to get people's attention, and it's got to be short and powerful and dramatic, and then people will listen. Otherwise, people will say, one bank has seen them all, you know.
Yeah. The only trouble is that I think in general that the bank wouldn't want to compete with the other banks as a depository commercial bank. So
well,
you're really talking about
deposits.
Saving.
No, it need not be a deposit institution. In other words, take deposits from, then you would clearly be competing with all the local private banks. You don't really want to do that, but you do want to, if you've got this huge pool of $54 billion, and certainly there could be other sources of government revenue sharing that the bank could add to its pool. I don't know. I think it's an exciting idea, but I do think you have to link it to something that people really see immediate personal benefit from. Anyway, again, tell people the blog where they can go and read more about your proposals here and follow your candidacy. Once again,
my blog is ellenbrown.com, and my campaign website is ellenbrown4treasurer4.org.
Okay, note that last one, folks, and periodically check it out, see what Ellen's proposing and the state of her candidacy. Ellen, before we go, though, I want to talk about two other topics here briefly. You were one of those writers who a year or so ago sort of broke the story of bail-ins, instead of bailouts of the banks. Explain to us what is a bail-in and why that may be next financial crisis the focus of policymakers and how they rescue the banks.
Well, and I would say bail-ins are another reason why we should have our own state-owned bank, because although it's hard to convince politicians of this, our public monies are at risk too. A bail-in is what happened in Cyprus, where the banks were told to convert deposits to capital, and they convert it was debt to equity. And in fact, you as a depositor are not, it's no longer your money that's in the bank, that you only have an IOU, so you're a creditor of the bank. That's what the actual law is. People think that's my money and they can't take it, but that's not true. It's their money. That's why J.P. Morgan and Bank of America can gamble with our money in their big speculative derivatives casinos, and they can get away with it because it's their money now, and all we have is an IOU and the right to write checks on our deposit account.
Ooh, did you hear that, everybody? When you put your money in the bank, it becomes their money. And what Ellen is saying, the next financial crisis, the response may be, okay, you've got $10,000 in a savings account in Wells Fargo. Well, Wells Fargo can say, I'm not going to let you take that out. I'm going to give you some worthless Wells Fargo stock instead.
Right.
That's
and
what a bail-in is, right, essentially.
Right, and they've actually been told to do that, so they can do it legally. Then we, in 2009, President Obama shook hands on a deal in London with the other G20 nations to be regulated by the Financial Stability Board, which is part of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And the Financial Stability Board then in 2010, I think, came out with a directive. At that point, it was becoming clear that countries were not going to willingly, governments were not willingly going to keep bailing out big bankrupt banks. You could tell that from ours with the Dodd-Frank Act says that in the event that we have another big derivatives bust like the Lehman Brothers crisis, that we, the people, are not going to be responsible, that the banks are on their own. That doesn't mean we might not bail out some more legitimate thing, but if it's just gambling, if they're just gambling with our money, we're not going to bail them out. So the big banks, the big systemically risky, systemically important, as they say, meaning the too big to fail banks, were required to come up with what were called living wills. These are, you know, a real living will is a directive where you say whether you want the plug pulled or that sort of thing. So these living wills are what the banks are supposed to do, or are going to say what they would do in the event of death. In other words, impending bankruptcy or insolvency, how they would get out of it. And they were told to do these debt for equity swaps where you would trade the IOUs of your creditors for equity in the bank. But as it turns out, the largest class of creditor of any bank is its depositors. So that means they're going to confiscate our money. Of course, they do it also. They use these great big words, and you can't really tell if that's exactly what they mean. But peering closely, that's what they mean. And then the public funds are supposedly securitized or collateralized. So if you bring this up to politicians, they'll say, oh, no, our funds are protected because we only put them in banks that have that amount in collateral. So we get the collateral if the bank goes bankrupt. But the catch is that collateral is what's called rehypothecated, which is another big word to conceal what they're really up to, which means that when you sign these deals for depositing your money, or you deposit your money in the stock market, you sign a thing that's very obscurely worded, or you agree with a little check on the thing on the computer or whatever, then that nobody ever reads. You know, you agree to all our terms and conditions, and you check that little box, and the terms say that they can rehypothecate your stock, which means they can lend it to somebody else. So that's what happened in the MF Global case, for example, where people thought that MF Global was holding their gold. I mean, it was like a real bail. It was a bailment, as they say in law. In other words, it was like putting your money in a safety deposit box. It's your money, and it's locked up. And that's what people thought, that was their money. But no, the gold disappeared, because it had been rehypothecated. It had been lent to somebody else, and the somebody else happened to be J.P. Morgan, who had a superior claim on it, supposedly, and just took the money. So that could also happen to our public funds. Under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, derivatives claims have super priority in bankruptcy. So that means this big bank that's been gambling with your money has a derivative claim on that collateral, can snatch the collateral And there's not going to be anything left for the public banks.
Oh, you mean ultra-high net worth individuals and institutions that own all the derivatives. They're going to get paid off first in the banking crisis, and all you poor simple checking and savings account depositors are going to lose your money, and you're going to get worthless bank stock. That's essentially what a bail-in is, isn't it?
And think of the state and local governments. How much money do they have in J.P. Morgan? And what are they going to do when they're broke, when the money's gone? What are they going to use to pay for all the services that we think government...
Right, everyone line up behind the big investors, because they're going to get theirs first, no matter what. Right. And the rest of us are not only going to lose, but we're going to get some crummy, worthless bank stock in the process. And by the way, politicians have slipped and said essentially that. There was a year or so ago some head of the European banking institutes over there in Europe who pretty much said that and then had to backtrack, and of course it's going on in Cyprus right now. So these folks are preparing for the next financial crash, and they're going to make us pay. And if we had a public bank, they couldn't do that. Okay, that's an important point. Before we go, Bitcoins. I want to say something about bitcoins. You know, all around the world, wealthy investors are speculating once again. Foreign exchange speculation, real estate in Hong Kong and elsewhere, derivatives, currencies. You know, the global money parade of wealthy individuals and their institutions. You know, I mentioned $71 trillion in the shadow banks, rising $4 trillion a year. These folks aren't interested in investing their money in real businesses, mom and pop, and real businesses that create jobs and income for folks. They go after these speculative bubbles around the world. It's much more profitable for them. You know, it generates a kind of a culture of speculation. And even folks in the middle class now are looking for these big yields. They want to make you know, big killings, big deals, a lot of money. And bitcoins, what are bitcoins? To me, you know, bitcoins are digital tulips. You know, the tulip mania back in the 17th century, where everybody, including small folks, middle-class folks, merchants, whatever, were buying these tulips. Because why? The tulips were rising in price. And the idea was to buy the tulips and the price rose, and then you could sell the tulips. It doesn't matter. Tulips become money. Money is whatever people think it is. And they thought tulips were money, and they were making, of course, the price goes up, and then it collapses. Someone says, time to take my money and run, and down it goes. I think that's what bitcoins are all about. And we're going to see in the next global financial crash, bitcoins are going to collapse in value, and people are going to lose their money. But, you know, bitcoins are a threat, aren't they? Bitcoins are a threat to the existing money systems based on the dollar, and they're a threat to the credit card companies because, you know, if people start buying stuff with bitcoins, then instead of credit cards, where is Visa going to get its interest from? Want to comment on bitcoins?
Right. Well, I agree. I mean, I don't own any bitcoins, and it would be my luck to buy right when they collapse. I mean, it has shot up very fast, and sometimes it drops very fast. So it's very vulnerable, very volatile right now. But I can see the attraction of it. There, I can see three things that are attractive about it. First of all, it's quite private. I mean, it's encrypted, so they can do drug trades, or, you know, they can do whatever they want with it. And it's not, at the moment, it's not taxed, but I think actually that's probably what will stop all that, is when the government decides to step in and say, wait, you all are doing all these trades without paying taxes, so we want full transparency here. We want to know, you know, we want to collect some tax. But like you say, they avoid the credit card charges, which are huge. Credit cards charge 2% per transaction, and on average, their loan is 2 weeks. So that's 2% for a two-week loan, if you stretch that out over a year, that's a 60% return for the credit card company, which is huge. And you can't avoid paying that. It's the people don't realize they're paying it. Everybody uses their credit cards thinking they're getting frequent flyer mileage. But the 2% is paid by the merchant. And the merchant gets it back by raising the prices across the board. So they can escape that. And there's the fact that many people are afraid of the collapse of the dollar. They think that quantitative easing is going to hyperinflate the system, which it isn't, because the money never makes it into the economy. And so it's like gold, you know, it's an alternative to gold, to something that looks secure that they can, it's like totally, it's private currency. So that's
okay. Okay. Well, I hear the music here. They're giving us a signal, Ellen, that we better wrap it up here. Bitcoin's an interesting topic. We'll have more to say about that, pluses and minuses, but a reflection, in my view, of the runaway speculative culture, speculative investing culture in the U.S. and globally, that, which leads to financial crashes. Ellen, thanks a lot for coming on and telling us about your candidacy. And again, Ellen Brown for Treasurer.org. is the website. Ellen, thanks. Hope to have you back. This is Jack Masters, Alternative Visions.